From Daylight, I'm Kazuki Akiba.
I'm Brandon Weiser.
And this is Sayonara Baseball. This is a podcast where you and I find unseen baseball gems by analyzing them alongside different trends, news, and motivation behind many moves around the league today.
On today's episode, we have reached the MLB divisional round, so it's time for a wild card round review and a divisional round preview. Today is October 5th, and welcome to another episode of Sayonara Baseball. My name is Brandon Weiser. With me is Kazuki Akiba. And again, to our very good and vaunted LinkedIn followers, I tried. We tried. It didn't work. So we're back on the audio first platform, and we'll try again for the next round. If anyone wants to help figure this out, be our guest. You know where the comment section is, and be kind. And we'll try to make sure we can try again next time. But until then, we have baseball to discuss. All right, Kazuki, 3 years ago, this is where we all started. We started after the first round. This is where you and I met. This is where you and I first started this whole thing. So tradition lives on yet again. We had four sweeps. The divisional round, meaning the wild card round, ended in two nights. We did not expect to have a podcast recording tonight on Thursday, October 5th, but we do. So let's get right into it. Let's review what happened on Tuesday night and Wednesday night. And we'll start in the American League with, I would say, the surprising result of all four. And you can lead us off. But the first thing we're going to talk about before we get to actual baseball, we mentioned that the St. Petersburg, Florida government mayor announced that they're going to stay there for 30 more years, build a new stadium and everything. And then they had a attendance that was paltry. According to records, 46% of the capacity was used over two games, which amounts to 39,902 fans of a possible 85,000 plus. For context, 39,902 fans, I believe, is like just a bit bigger than one Fenway. That's small.
And it's for two games. And, you know, we're going to probably do like a deep dive episode regarding the attendance issues for Tampa Bay Rays because of the fact that they're a successful franchise for the past 6 years. And yet they can't even get their fans to come in. There's a lot of elements, but I would say for this one, it's also the time the game is started. It was during daytime.
Right. They were a 3 p.m. start. It's a school day. It's not a holiday of any kind. And also, like, so the location is not perfect. So that's it. So we'll go to game one. First thing I noticed about game one, the Rays had four errors, three throwing, one fielding. They really threw Siri to the wall on this one, literally and figuratively. It was just a messy game. Glasnow allowed a run on a wild pitch. There were, I believe, three errors in the first four innings. Is that correct?
Yep. And one of the wild throw from Siri really hurt it because that allowed another runner to come in, which is the one unearned run from Glasnow.
Right. And that, so Glasnow's line was, other than, you know, the runs, was quite good. He had five walks, which is a little too high for him. So five innings pitched, six hits, four runs, three of them earned, five walks, eight Ks again across five innings, compared with Jordan Montgomery, who had a sensational, though surprising, diving catch off a bunt in the early innings. He pitched seven innings, six hits, five Ks, no runs allowed, period.
And this is a good, vengeance story for Jordan Montgomery because he was famously ousted, I would say, by the current GM of the New York Yankees, Brian Cashman, last year when he was traded to the Cardinals for Harrison Bader, because of the fact that he thought Montgomery was not a postseason pitcher. And this game line definitely is a middle finger to the Yankees organization.
Spot
just reminding people, go watch the highlight. Kazuki, if we're lucky, we'll be able to cut it in. It's just an odd watch. Even on the radio, it was an odd catch to have. It was just unusual. But he made a great play, potentially hurt himself. And, you know, here he is. And then Siri back in the lineup, playing in center field immediately was a tough ask for a player just coming off the IL, I thought, personally. So that was something I noticed. Anything else on game one? It's a quick game. Nothing really special in the fact that Rays didn't score.
I mean, it's a great game for the Texas Rangers, their pitching staff. I thought that was the one weakness they had, especially their bullpen. You know, Aroldis Chapman, Jose Leclerc, they shut him down in game one. It was a very clean game for the Texas Rangers. Very Bruce Bochy-esque, I would say, for what he's used to.
The broadcast kept talking about. This was Bruce Bochy as a Giants manager several years ago. Same. And then game two, Rays can't score again. Very surprising. They don't score until they were trailing by 7 runs. Rangers slugging like crazy. Evan Carter gets a home run. I believe on the broadcast mentioned how young he was, maybe the one of the youngest, if not the youngest Texas Rangers player ever to hit a postseason home run in franchise history, which was great for them because it wasn't Semien, it wasn't Seager, it wasn't Garcia, it was Evan Carter.
And not to mention, this is one of the many talent that the Texas Rangers have in their farm system, and there's a lot more that's not have been called up yet that will be coming in in the next couple seasons.
Yeah, this team is deep because before the past couple of years they were very bad, but they also had a lot of usually generally bad teams get, you know, trade away their good players, get farm players, grow talent organically themselves. They do. Evan Carter is one of those players. Zach Eflin may have been effective as a Phillies pitcher. He was not as a Rays pitcher in the playoffs. 5 innings, 8 hits, all 5 earned runs, 2 walks, 3 strikeouts, gave up 2 home runs. There's the conversation that he could have been tipping pitches. I have not seen anything either for or against that right now, but it was not pretty. Nathan Eovaldi on the other side pitched great. 6 hits, 1 earned run, 8 Ks over 6 2/3. Game set match, final 7-1. I turned it off like 5 o'clock and moved over to the Blue Jays Twins series.
Yeah, let's just move on to that next series. I mean, congrats to our friend Ryan Stoll, who worked at the Rangers, and he had a bracket that I shared with him, and he definitely picked the Rangers going all the way. Congrats to him. It's moving on. They're moving on to the next round. And my race kind of sucked. So let's move to the next exciting game instead.
Blue Jays Twins. I would say, like I said, the hockey matchup compared to the other one, 99.8% capacity of Target Field both games. People were out in vocal loud force at Target Field.
And Brandon, Twins, we know why they're so excited and what happened. That's very monumental, I would say, right?
So let's all travel back to Moneyball era Oakland Athletics. David Ortiz is on the Twins. That was the last time this franchise had a winning. They beat the Moneyball Oakland Athletics, made it to the ALDS against the Yankees.
No, actually, it's like ALCS because they beat them in an ALDS and then they lost to the Angels in 0-2. And that was, I think, one of their last like winning series in a postseason. Right.
The last time they won a series was
in 0-2.
An 0-2 against Oakland. The last win they had as a franchise was in the ALDS in 2004 against the Yankees. So as you can just imagine what Kooks and I are talking about, it's been a while. Like I said, we're talking about David Ortiz. As a twin, last time they won a series.
And then this last time they won a game was when Johan Santana was pitching for them, and that was their only victory. And then the curse started. They have not won 18 games straight since then, over 20 years. And seems like it's like, I don't want to curse the Blue Jays, but it seems like it's tradition where if the curse team plays the Blue Jays, they always end up winning the series, I think, is
I think the Blue Jays just had the wrong opponent. They had the wrong opponent last year in the Mariners, and the wrong opponent this year in the Twins, because the Twins match well with them on the field. But other than the external factors, the internal factors, like the Twins are great. The Twins are a good team. Royce Lewis, I still don't understand how this man hits so many home runs so quickly in his career. He hits a multi-home run game in his first postseason game. Pablo Lopez goes 5 2/3, 5 hits with 1 earned run, 2 walks and 3 strikeouts. And let's just quickly talk about who Pablo Lopez is. Pablo Lopez graduated high school at age of 16. He was a medical school admittee before signing with the Mariners as an international free agent. And he currently has intermediate or greater fluency in 4 languages, English, Italian, Portuguese, and Spanish. So he is a very well-traveled, well-educated young man, and coming up from the Marlins to the Twins, he pitched a great game. And this is why the Twins were so excited to have him on their roster. Kevin Gausman, on the other side, had a rather unremarkable game. 4 innings pitched, 3 hits, gave up 3 earned runs. That was all the runs they needed. 3 walks, 5 strikeouts. The other factor about this, the external factor, which I point out to Kazuki, and I texted you very quickly when I saw this, the game time temperature was close to 85 degrees in Minneapolis on game one, which is very unseasonal. Compared to game two, the game time temperature was closer to 62 degrees.
This is where we want to really talk about this controversial game.
We're going to spend some time on this, because if you remember one of the first postseason podcasts Kazuki and I did, we broke down the Blake Snell approach to pitching. I think it was in the World Series in 2020 when you and I went through why Blake Snell doesn't pitch to the batters a third time around.
Yeah.
And now we see it with the Blue Jays. So we're going to go through this probably more detail than we probably should, but I think it is so important that we see this trend and how it has transition to other teams from the Kevin Cash led Tampa Bay Rays. So walk us through what happened with Berríos.
So Berríos actually had a bounce back season compared to the previous year, and he's been pitching to mid 3 ERA. And I think I shouldn't have done this full analysis on his pitching style this year for 2023, but here I am talking about it. So let's look at his stat line first. So this is a really baffling decision that we have to kind of think about and kind of think like the Blue Jays front office. So Berríos pitched 3 innings, only allowed 3 hits, 1 run earned because of the pitcher who came in next, which we'll explain later, 1 walk and 5 strikeouts. So that's not many plate appearances. So we're talking about 12 plate appearances, 11 at bats because of the walk, 3 hits, and they were all singles. And then 1 walk. So, and let's look at the breakdown of what those hits were looking like. So batting average against was .273 based off this, and his expected batting average is .198, which means that none of the balls were hard hit at all with those singles. And let's look at the average exit velo for all those 12 plate appearances against Jose Berríos. So it was 79.7 miles per hour for average exit velo. And a launching goal was -6 degrees. So that means none of the balls were elevated against him. And let's look at the max. The max hard hit ball was under 100 miles, so 94.7 miles. And the max distance against him was 267 feet. So to me, like, he's having a great, phenomenal game at that point. And you kind of wonder, why would a manager pull a pitcher who's really drilling down this offense? It's very perplexing. So we have to really dive into his splits this year to see what may have caused, John Snyder to pull Berríos in this game. So let's look at the first time around the order. Yeah, his stats lines, .218 batting average against, .357 slugging, 8 home runs allowed, 69 Ks, and 266 at bats. Pretty solid for a first time around. So next part is the second time around. That's when Berríos got pulled in this elimination game. So second time around this season, he's .221 batting average against, .382 slugging, 10 home runs allowed, 70 Ks, against 267 at-bats. So still a solid number. The home run rate might be kind of high, which I could see why it's, but I don't think that's the reason why they pulled it. So in third time around, obviously most pitchers go up a lot. 304 batting average against, 378 slugging, 7 home runs, 45 Ks against 148 at-bats. So, okay, if it's not about how many times he's facing the batter, then what are the splits? So I looked at the weight splits this season for him since he was away in Minnesota, which would be 5-6, 397 ERA, 99 and two-thirds innings, and 91K. Not also respectable stat, not bad. And it was during the day, so let's like look at it as day game stat, which was 4-0, 244 ERA, 48 innings pitch, and 48 strikeout, which means he's a pretty good day game starter, so even more perplexing reason to pull him. So, okay, let's break down. Maybe he hasn't been so hot lately. So let's look at his overall post-All-Star game stat. 3-6, 3.86 ERA, 81 and two-thirds innings pitched, 83 strikeout. That kind of doesn't indicate to me that he hasn't been bad in the second half. So, okay, let's look even more of a recency bias and look at September, which is 2-2. 3.41 ERA, 31 and two-thirds innings pitched with 38 Ks. Pretty good split overall for the month of September. So, okay, so I'm kind of wondering why would we pull a guy who's been pretty consistent for the most part and been having a good game so far. So now I looked at each inning breakout, and then now we could see why he may have been pulled. So if we look at every inning for ERA, his highest ERA comes around in the fourth inning where he has an ERA of 5.34 ERA, 32 innings pitched, 32 hits, 4 home runs, 19 earned runs, and it was a 1.25 whip, which is his highest, while the rest are in the high threes and low twos, depending on which innings. The first inning, 3.94 ERA, second inning, 2.81, third inning, 1.41, fifth, 4.6, sixth, 4.56, and seventh, 2.25. So based on all of these stats that we about just now that I really went over really quickly, my theory is the Blue Jays front office chose to have a game plan where Berríos gets pulled in the fourth inning. And as soon as the runner got on, because the home run rate is also high, that they would insert in a reliever, which to me now the next step is which reliever you should have done. So to me, like you would pick a guy was a very good high leverage situation type of scenario. But then you put in a starter for this Yusei Kikuchi. So let's look at why they would put in Yusei Kikuchi for this. So Kikuchi, first of all, has not pitched any relief role this season. He did it last season because he was really bad at starting. But this season, he's been a solid starter, bounced back very nicely. But something doesn't click because he has a runner on. So let's look at it. His splits based on runner at first this season. So 32 games. 39 and two-thirds innings pitched was 33 hits, 8 home runs, 13 walks, 31 Ks, which seems it's okay for his runners on first, but why would you put him in if he has a just an okay stat to shut it down in the playoff game? So, okay, let's look at a stat versus lefties, which is 36 and a third innings pitched, 214 batting average against, 389 slugging, 6 home runs, 17 earned runs, which equates to 4.24 ERA. That seems just okay, but why? It's like a Ubaldo Jimenez situation was Buck Showalter in a 2016 wild card game against Toronto, which is ironic that Toronto is pulling this, that they're pulling in a wild card starter and Yusei Kikuchi instead of pulling in their other options. So, and the other reason we could see is the fact that because there were back-to-back lefties, that they didn't want Berríos to face because of Kepler and Kirilloff coming up. They thought a lefty-lefty matchup made sense, but does it make sense putting Gucci when Tim Mesa and Hyunjin Ryu were available out of the bullpen, which kind of is baffling theory. So my theory is it's probably a mix of lefty-lefty matchup and the fact that they didn't want Berríos to pitch beyond the fourth inning, unless he didn't allow any runners. Yeah, this is one of the baffling decisions I've ever seen from this front office.
It was so obvious. It was so obvious. I appreciate everyone. So if you want to read that back, that was about 5 minutes of Kazuki doing his best form of baseball analysis. So go listen to it back. Watch the highlight if you find it. It was just this odd sequence. Like even Berríos looked like he looked despondent, just in the dugout, just looking out at the at Kikuchi just lose the game. And he's just deeps a deep sigh and just sits there because he knew he was defenseless. He had nothing he could do. He did his part, and he was just, he got set up and he did his best to set him up, and he wasn't in the, he just got taken out. I don't think he's even, I'm not sure. I couldn't really tell if he was surprised or not, but it was just, he was taken out. But we'll go on with the rest of the game.
Yeah, and those were the only two runs allowed, by the way, that during that inning. So
yeah, it
that,
was 2-0.
Screw the final, ball game.
2-0. Yeah. Vlad got picked off second by Sonny Gray and Carlos Correa, which was a pretty cool moment to watch in the fifth. But the sixth inning, I watched this play and I watched the replay several times. So Sonny Gray is now taken out of the game. Minnesota goes to their bullpen. First bullpen pitcher comes up. People get on. Then they get another. And then another pitcher comes on. Another batter gets on. So the base is loaded with one out for Matt Chapman. And Matt Chapman hits a rope down the left field line. And it was missed by 5 inches, 4 inches from the white line. And you could see everyone just take a loud players, fans, everyone. Next, grounds with the double play, inning ending double play, game over, inning over. And Matt Chapman was just, it's like, how did I get myself into this position? Because later on the game, Minnesota's Duran comes in the ninth, almost left the game with like a blister on his finger. Close out the series, game over, two straight Ks against Matt Chapman and Varsho. Minnesota moves on to play the Houston Astros, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But we're going to get now to the National League. And Kazuki, I'm going to stand by what I said in the last podcast. Diamondbacks Brewers was the most interesting series. Had two comebacks by the Diamondbacks. At American Family Insurance, I almost all call it Miller Park, but it's Miller Family Insurance field in Milwaukee. Game one, Corbin Carroll, Ketel Marte, back-to-back home runs. Gabriel Moreno had a solo home run. Tyrone Taylor, who you played Little League with, that hit a two-run home run. Diamondbacks using Brandon Fad for their starter, lasted two and two-thirds innings and just kind of like held himself together, just did what he could. Carlos Santana, RBI single. Evan Longoria with the defensive play of the game. Bases were loaded, end of the inning on a fantastic play. Arizona bullpen was the story of this series. But in this game, 6 1/3, 5 innings pitched, no runs allowed, 3 walks and 7 Ks. The Diamondbacks pulling away late after a double by Christian Walker over after Devin Williams. I think the final score was 6-3 on this one. I didn't see that one coming. Game two, a little more of a routine affair. Again, with a comeback, Brewers got out ahead, only for the Diamondbacks to come back and from behind and win. Zach Gallen started versus Freddy Peralta. Scary moment was Gabriel Moreno getting left with a head injury early in the game after getting hit in the head with a bat on a foul ball. They brought in their backup, and the bullpen, again, performed above expectations. Paul Seawell closed out the game, even though he gave a late inning double to Yelich, and surprise, surprise, Diamondbacks moving on. That's the quick one on that one, and we'll go quickly for the Marlins and the Phillies here. This game was sold out and loud.
Very loud.
Reports are that there was a standing room only situation at the bank where 91,000 plus fans filled a stadium that could only fit 85,000 over two games. So there was about 5,000, closer to 6,000 standing room only fans in attendance over the course of two games, which is very Philadelphia. Game one, Rhys Hoskins throws the ceremonial first pitch after tearing his ACL this year and unable to play. Zach Wheeler dominant again. Bryson Stott has an RBI single. Alec Bohm has an RBI single. Brian De La Cruz provides the only run for the Marlins. Alvarado, Hoffman, Kimbrel, shut the door, game over, lock it up, end the game. Game one
very,
was done.
Very solid, like probably laid out game for Rob Thompson for this game, very much in their plan. Wheeler shutting everyone down, and then the bullpen also doing their job. And yep, easy game.
Easy game. Game two, Aaron Nola, gem of a game. 7 innings pitched, 3 hits, 1 walk, 3 Ks. In his last 2 starts, Kazuki, how has he performed? Because it seems like he's been pretty much unstoppable.
Yeah, so in the last, Nola's been, he's pitching to a mid 4 ERA this season. He's been pretty bad for his standards. And obviously, it's not good for his walk here, but the last 2 starts, he made a major adjustments to its game. So stat line wise, he pitched 6 innings pitch, 6 hits, 2 earned runs, 8K against the Atlanta Braves, which was a win for him. And then 6 2/3 innings pitch, 4 hits, 1 run, 1 earned, 8K against the Pirates. And the reason why he started to find success is his control has been really off with his breaking pitch and his 2-seamer this season. So he, like David Cone mentioned in the ESPN broadcast, he changed his positioning on the pitching rubber where he stood. I think it's a little bit more on the third base side, but more centered, which allowed for better deception to hide his curveballs and breaking pitches, but also have a better control so that his 2-seamer and sinker kind of goes into the righties and away from the lefties, which has been pretty effective for this series against the Marlins, which is more right-handed heavy than left-handed hitting heavy. So I think that was a key to success. And obviously, Brandon, the bullpen was excellent.
The bullpen was excellent. And I want to point out one name, and that is the player who had a very special moment with his father when he made his MLB debut, and that's Orion Kerkering. When I watch Orion Kerkering pitch, because you got to be, I'm curious to hear your opinion after Gregory Soto too. When I watch Orion Kerkering, I just expect strikes on everything, be it the fastball, the breaking pitches. It's just, he is quick work, smart work, efficient, and just out. And it seems like the fans have really got onto that, especially with the one with his father that was shared widely. People just know, it's like there is a special quality about him, about how he came up in the system very well, and he came into a tight spot late in the year, become like a very important setup man, and he's just been effective. He threw 9 pitches in the inning that he pitched. He had only 1 ball. He had 2 flyouts and a strikeout. It was a 9-pitch inning, but not an immaculate inning. And just a job well done. Gregory Soto as well, close out the game. I think he pitched quite well. And then the moment that everyone kind of talked about was when Bryson Stott hit that grand slam, he slammed the bat down. And apparently, although I've not actually seen this myself, people compared it to how Reese Hoskins.
Oh, okay. Yes, I remember. That was back in the NLDS game 3 at home, I believe, last right? When year. He hit that home run against
right,
Strider.
He slammed the bat down. And people that say it was running them. Bryson Stott obviously has had some pretty monumental home runs as a young player for the Phillies. So that's how the series ended.
Yeah.
So all in all, any final impression about the wild card round?
My quick
impression is nobody scored. Like in three series, one team scored 1 run or fewer.
I think the Brewers scored more than half on the losing side. Brewers is the one who pretty much carried the weight. Rays and American League side, Blue Jays. Obviously, we talked about the Blue Jays' flaws of not being clutch, and it kind of showed here where there's a lot of base running blunders, bad coaching overall that, you know, I think we could all joke that Vlad said 2021 was a trailer, 2022 was a terrible movie, and 23, I think, is a direct sequel to a direct DVD sequel.
Well done,
you know, it was such a horrible, horrible movie for the Blue Jays fans. And I would say my biggest complaints, and I think I texted you about this, is the ESPN broadcast.
The in-game interviews were not, they were just not what we needed this game.
Yeah, and it's just really, really awkward, you know, like, and they're interviewing the manager in the middle of the game that they're managing, and they're like all ears and eyes on, like, that is like one of the worst ways to just have a broadcast going. And it's clearly that the managers don't even want to talk to them. They want to just focus on the game. It's just a horrible timing. And then the cameras, the angles and the cameras they use for like some of the games, like if you compare the Brewers setup from the Bally Sports games to versus to what it is in ESPN. They're not using the center field camera. That's way more better position than, you know, it's like clearer and you can see like center, like straight up from a pitcher's point of view. And, you know, ESPN just does a horrible job on its broadcast that kind of makes me really cringe watching it. I thought the Apple broadcasts are bad, but like outside of the Michael Kay like booth, which I like Michael Kay, listening to Michael Kay for the most part, it's just a very much of a cringe broadcast experience to just watch these games. And I'm just happy to say I'm excited to just watch Ron Darling for TBS for the next round.
Ron Darling, Brian Anderson, we're getting the crew back together. And those players, we'll see who they bring through to comment for both sides with FS1, Fox, and TBS, because I think with Fox, they have to pull a few people from the football side. They used to football,
Davis, he's a baseball guy, voice of the Dodgers.
Right. And we heard Steven Nelson a lot this year, so a lot more national work for him. And then Brian Anderson, obviously, is the Turner side and is so good. Like people probably expect who listen to this podcast, I listen to every game on local radio and watched a few, but, you know, shout out to the Brewers broadcast, shout out to the Phillies broadcast, and shout out to the unfortunate Tampa Bay Rays broadcast, because they're very good, but that game was very and the Treasure Island Radio Network in Minneapolis was quite good. But it's time to, you know, we've concluded. Today's episode of Sayonara Baseball was presented by Anchor. Anchor is a platform that helps us create and deliver you this podcast wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. Anchor is available at no cost to its users and is accessible at home or on the go. To get started with creating your own work on Anchor, visit anchor.fm/start. That's anchor.fm/start. Welcome back. We are here now previewing divisional round games. Before the break, we looked at what happened in the wildcard round. So divisional round preview, we start in the American League and we are going to Space City, Houston, Texas. Minnesota Twins will visit the Houston Astros. These games will be on your local Fox broadcast station or FS1. And Kazuki, I'll start here, but I put some pitching statistics here and I think you are better elaborating at what's going on here, but just some quick headlines in this game. It's a Carlos Correa revenge series. Carlos Correa, if healthy, he got hurt on the hand in the last year in the wild card round, will face his former team. And that's kind of the main Twins stat and story coming into this after, you know, a very good performance. And then obviously, this lineup for the Astros is very much what they had in 2022. They even got Justin Verlander back from the Mets.
Yeah, it's essentially the same roster, right? From like they're running it back with the same gang, and then plus Kendall Graveman from the White Sox trade.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. We have Framber Valdez, Christian Javier have been there the whole season, so their stats are 31 games started apiece. Valdez is a 3.45 ERA, Javier is a 4.56 ERA. They both have about 9 Ks per 9 innings and about 3-ish walks per 9 innings as well. The one question I have for you is, do we have a good picture of how they're going to factor in Hunter Brown France? Because they pitched quite well this year, especially Hunter Brown.
Yeah, Hunter Brown was supposed to be the prospect that was supposed to replace Justin Verlander. As many of you guys know, they have a very similar pitching motion, very much the same type of delivery and same type of arsenal. Outside of Verlander having a curveball, he really struggled in the second half. And I think based on where Houston is trying to go for, was Verlander taking probably game one, Valdez game two, was Urquidy or someone else in the game three, game four, now that Lance McCullers out for the entire season. Brown and JP France, I think they're going to be a long arm and they're going to come in relief whenever they can, whenever it's not a tight game or whenever Danny Lent before they go to their big four arms, which are Brian Abreu, Hector Neris, to an extent, Rafael Montero, and then, or you could say Kendall Graveman is the big arm instead of Rafael Montero, and then Ryan Pressly, their closer. So they do have a game plan, and it's run by Dusty Baker. So like Bruce Bochy, more of a traditional approach, and He has a lot of loyalty to his players. A lot of Astros fans I know hates Maldonado. And I think we'll see less of Yonier Diaz, who's probably the better cat player to play. But
Diaz is one of the few players in the team with 20 or more, more than 20 home runs this year, which I thought was kind of surprising.
Yeah, with limited appearance, and Dusty's very loyal to Dubon and Maldonado, who are not great hitters. But I'll just say this, Dubon has been great in the month of September, crushed the Mariners, crushed the Rangers, and crushed the Arizona Diamondbacks. So, no shade there. I think, I can't question Dusty in some ways, but I should question him. But that is where I'm at.
Yeah, and the quick ending stat on the Houston Astros to look for, Kasuki mentioned Brian Rayo and Hector Neris. Both have sub-2 ERAs in 70 or more appearances this year, which is quite impressive and very important. Kasuki, remind me in the last couple games of the year, there was one Houston Astros pitcher in the Mariners series in particular, and maybe in the Diamondbacks series, who got very animated. And I think it got on the nerves of the opposing team. Was that Brian Abreu?
No, that's Hector Neris.
That was Hector Neris. And it kind of got under the skin of a few people. And I wonder how much if the umps are going to be kind of looking for that, especially considering the stakes and circumstances here. But we'll see how that goes.
I think it's a one-off to me. It was a situation because Hector Neris is more of a quiet guy. So I was a little bit surprised when I saw that in the Mariners series. And obviously the Mariners, crushed or just choked, let's put it that way, and couldn't even rally back from that. So I'm going to leave it at that.
Yep. So quick keys for success. This one was me. The Twins, I think that starting pitcher needs to keep the game close and in check because that's where their strength is for the Twins. And defense has to be your best friend. After what the Twins did against the Blue Jays, turning double plays, picking off players at first and second, they play great defense. And I think that will, if you keep the ball in front of you, as our loyal friends of our softball team like to say, you have a better chance of winning. So this is going to be one of those times where I'm going to quote my good friend Stephanie and say, respect 90. Because you really got to respect 90 on defense in this case, because you definitely get some easy double play balls and make use of those. If you can. And the Astros, it's all the experience in the world. It's the same. They're running it back. It's like the Bulls of the 90s. Just run it back again and see how well you do. So we'll see how well that goes.
I agree with you. You know, particularly with the Astros, I think it's Astros will go as far as their bats will go. If like Yordan, Kyle Tucker, those particular player Altuve, if they don't hit, I don't think the Astros could go far. So this is a similar situation that they faced last year against the Mariners in a similar way. It's a similar type of team that they're facing. Mariners and Twins, Mariners of last year and Twins of this year, streaky hitting team, solid pitching for the most part, of like a lot of no names and top of the line starting pitching. So the Astros, if they could get some clutch home runs and hits, I think they'll win the series and they'll go far in the postseason.
Well, if they go far, I hope they play the team we're going to talk about next, which is the Baltimore Orioles. Baltimore Orioles are hosting the Texas Rangers. This game will also be on your local Fox station or FS1. On Saturday afternoon, we are getting postseason baseball at Camden Yards. It feels right. It feels good. So let's talk about the Baltimore Orioles. They have arguably the best pitching staff of the second half. I will say that their rotation has been good, and they got back John Means from an injury. So Kasuki, walk us through, introduce us to those who have not been able to see this, to the Baltimore Orioles in particular, that incredible.
Yeah, as you mentioned, Baltimore second half was a sub-3 ERA, been a very solid pitching team, and you don't expect that. Kyle Bradish, who's been solid last few seasons, been pitching to a 3 ERA, has been solid. And then Gibson, obviously, is not your typical good pitcher, but someone you need, someone who could give you innings. He eats a lot of innings, pitching to 4 or 5 ERA. And then you have Dean Kramer, from that Manny Machado trade that's coming into fruition, that's been working too well. And then lastly, they caught up their top pitching prospect in Grayson Rodriguez, who had an 8 ERA in the first few seasons before being demoted back to the minors, and then coming back and pitching all the way to 4 ERA. So, you know, good bounce back for him, and it's exciting. But I think their biggest strength right now is their bullpen. And their bullpen was led by their closer, Felix Bautista, who is unfortunately out with a UCL injury. But he filled in very nicely in the first half. And without him, I don't think the Orioles would have gone far last season and this season. And he had a line of 33 saves, 61 inning pitch, was a 16.23 K per nine, which is a 1.48 ERA, which translates to 1.88 FIP. And he left 84% of runners on base, which is incredibly freakish. And we all witnessed him throwing 100 miles an hour with his nasty 90-mile splitter. You just cannot hit this guy. He is a tough hitter, but he has a great supporting cast as the Orioles bullpen the whole year pitched a 3.55 ERA with a 72% left on base percentage. And it's led also by Yennier Cano, which who came from last year's Twins trade when they traded away their closer Jorge Lopez. And he is having an incredible All-Star season. 72 games pitched, 81% left on base to a 2.11 ERA, which is phenomenal. And then we have other players, former Houston Astro, Danny Colombe, 61 games pitched, 17 Ks per nine. Freakishly ridiculous there, was a 2.81 ERA and 78.7% left on base. And DL Hall, their pitching prospect, is a reliever in this case, was a respectable 3.26 ERA. And Senio Perez, who I believe is from the Houston Astros, is having a decent, solid season out of the bullpen, 65 games pitched, 3.54 ERA. And those are their top four arms, and they have way more arms they could use. Was a Jacob Webb, who came off from the waivers from the Angels, who's been solid. Baker, and you have the trade from Shintaro Fujinami coming from the A's. And then you have Jack Flaherty, who was acquired during the trade deadline from the St. Louis Cardinals. So this is going to be an interesting bunch. And Brandon, you have a lot of notes on the hitting side.
Yeah, I love this roster. I think if you've listened to this podcast for years, I love this roster. They're not a power hitting team. Anthony Santander led the team with only 28 home runs and 95 RBIs. They have no player with 100 RBIs. A team that won 100 games has no player with 100 RBIs, which I think is quite impressive because they spread the wealth. Adley Rutschman has a 128 OPS plus. Gunnar Henderson has a 105 OPS plus. These people have been in the league for like a hot minute, like maybe a year or two. The youth of this team has fueled them. The question is, none of them have really been this far. I mean, Adam Frazier is the old man of the lineup, and we'll see how much he has tons of experience playing Major League
and
Baseball.
And don't forget, Yankees are probably hitting their life right now. Aaron Hicks is also in this roster,
who has played beautifully for this team with rotating with Cedric Mullins in the outfield. And then kind of the question that, because you and I have kind of bowing back and forth with this, is like, how is their lineup going to look for this team? Their likely roster is probably going to include Rutschman, James McCann, Ryan Mountcastle, Ryan O'Hearn, Adam Frazier, Jordan Westberg, Gunnar Henderson, Jorge Mateo, Ramon Urias, Austin Hayes, Cedric Mullins, Aaron Hicks, Anthony Santander. And if you're listening to that lineup, you're like, who are these people? I'm like, good. Welcome to the National. This is going to be fun. These players are so exciting and they're very good, but they're also very young, which is my general concern about.
Right. It was a playoff, right. And I agree. And I saw them in Sarasota this year during their spring training. And this lineup is electric. And we haven't mentioned the crop of that talent that still hasn't been caught up, including Jackson Holliday, Heston Kjerstad. There's so many great bats.
We saw Kjerstad for a hot minute this year. I don't believe he qualifies to be on the final roster or he's available. But Jordan Westberg was called this year, did amazing. Gunnar Henderson had a year for the ages, it felt like. And then you go back to the players who have been there for a while. Austin Hayes, Anthony Santander, Cedric Mullins. They've been there for a little couple of years. And obviously, the man behind the plate has a calmness about him that we cannot overstate. I think it means the world to those people to have you look down, you looked at your battery partner, it's Adley Rutschman. It's like, I'm okay. It's like, it's that Yadier Molina effect for years on the Cardinals. You look down, he's like, I know I'm okay. I know I'm okay. And this team is built very well. We talked about their bullpen. What will happen with, and there was a pitching, Jack Flaherty, how is he going to fit in? And then for hitting, where's Ryan McKenna going to fit in? So this will be a fun series to watch. It's my series to watch. I think it's Kazuki's series to watch to a certain degree too. That's what I really kind of really means something. And my final stat about this little starting lineup, which is just incredible. If you, according to Baseball Reference, there is a possible lineup that can be created from players in this, a 10 person starting lineup from catcher all the way to DH. So one to 10 that could have played 110 games or more this season, which is remarkable. They have a cohesion that cannot be understated. They have a fan base that loves them so much. The Oriole Park at Camden Yards, the splash zone is going to be going nuts on Saturday. And then again on Sunday, I believe Sunday, when the games begin. So it's just an incredible series. Keys for success. Number one for the Rangers. Can they keep up the home runs and chase the starters for Baltimore? Can they also work deep into counts and keep making the Baltimore pitchers work? That's what I also really want to see. And do not let Baltimore stay on the bases. Baltimore is a contact hitting team. All they need is a single and runs. All they need. Because they don't steal a lot of bases, but you got to get one or two singles and they are bound to keep players coming. That's a momentum team. They're going to keep the ball in. The Orioles' keys to success is allowing the stars to go deep into games, especially that rotation, the pitching deep to save that great bullpen. You brought up a couple of things. Their contact hitting won a couple of games, but they also have, you told me that they really need a hit with runners in scoring position. Like I said, they're a contact team. So if they get a runner on second, there you go. That's all you need. Get a runner on, their doubles. They get a lot of doubles and singles. They're not a home run hitting team. They're just going to keep the players moving. And this may be the one series, other than the one American League series, where the home crowd in Baltimore is going to matter so much. In Philadelphia, it's great, but in Baltimore, it's probably close to as good, maybe even better, because they haven't been here for several years, and they are so excited that
and they're hungry. You know, they went through one of the biggest rebuild, just like the Houston Astros did.
Sarah Lang's fact of the season: the Baltimore Orioles are the only team in baseball history to go from a 100 loss season to a 100 win season, three seasons. That's insane. That is a 200 game swing.
Yep. And we know who the architect was for that, which is Michael Elias, who came from the Houston Astros organization, which is an organization that did a similar path to their rebuild. And here we are. We might be seeing another dynasty here, Brandon.
Which is awesome. I mean, we're all Mariners fans on this podcast, but goodness gracious, the Baltimore is so much fun to watch. So that's one thing we watch. And now, Kazuki, I turn it over to you to tell us about first of the National League divisional rounds, because also a divisional matchup. So these games, Philly versus Braves, will be on TBS. And if you're following us on LinkedIn, you saw what I wrote. This is game will be available on the new Max Bleacher Report sports tier, which is free to all Max subscribers. So if you do not have cable, watch these games on your Max subscription. But let's get into it. Braves, Phillies, NL East rivals.
Well, first, Braves, you know, had an incredible season. At one point, we thought they would surpass the Mariners record, but they obviously slowed down. But they're having an incredible month. Brandon, you wrote here, they led a head-to-head against the Philadelphia Phillies, 7-6. Going to be a very, very tight matchup. In the month of September, they played each other 7 times and Braves won 4. So this is going to be a very interesting, I think this might be the key matchup. And I think one person that I work with in a sports org is a major, major Braves fan. And he's definitely going to be watching this one.
They want revenge. The last thing we'll talk about before we get into the team is Philadelphia played them last year in the division series, and they them out.
Yep, 3-1, and they split the series in Truist Field, which is again game one is back in Truist Field in Atlanta again. But then Phillies just demolished them once they came back to Philadelphia in Citizens Bank Park. But first, let's talk about the Braves. They're a very unique team, probably the smartest team that I've seen so far, outside of Tampa Bay Rays and the LA Dodgers. So I wanted to kind of look into the financials because I feel like not many podcasts would dive into the financials of a team. And their payroll this season is $208.8 million. And in that payroll itself, the roster generated 56.2 Fangraph WAR, and 39.6 came from position players and 16.6 came from the pitchers. And we need to talk about the Braves because they have two MVP candidates within the same team. And one of them will not, despite breaking records, will not be probably the MVP this season because of this man, Ronald Acuña Jr., who hit .337, was 41 home runs, 73 stolen bases, was a low 11.4% K rate, was a WRC plus of 170, and that generated 8.3 WAR. And guess what? He's only getting paid $17 million a year. What a phenomenal season by him. 40-70 season. It is crazy. And then I want to talk about his partner in crime, who is an MVP candidate. And if Acuña or Betts were not here, he would probably be winning the MVP. And that is Matt Olson, Atlanta native, who came from the Oakland trade last year. And he is having himself one of the best seasons of his career, hitting .283, 54 home runs, 139 RBIs, was a 14.4% walk rate, and a slugging of .604, and a WRC plus of 160, was a 6.7 WAR as a first baseman, where a WAR gets, as a first baseman, you get penalized so much from that position, and he still generated close to 7 WAR this season. And fun fact about Olson, he is the 2023 MLB Home Run King this season, and he tied for the most home run in franchise history was Eddie Matthews. This guy is having a season of his career, and he's only getting paid $21 million from that team extension from last season. And that is the most paid person in the roster so far, which is insane. And then we got to highlight the offense, Brandon. Their offense was just going off the chart this season. So they had 7 players with 20 or more home runs this season, starting with Matt Olson, the home run king, and Ronald Acuña Jr. hitting 41. And then they had another 40 home run hitter in Marcell Ozuna. And then we had Austin Riley, who also signed to a friendly 10-year extension worth $250 million. And Ozzy Albies, who also hit 33 home runs in the 30 home run club. Probably criminally underpaid at this point, was his 8-year, $24 million extension. Just a steal from the Braves. And then lastly, you have Sean Murphy, who came from the Oakland trade this season, helping out in the catcher spot, hitting 21 home runs. And Eddie Rosario, your NLCS hero in 2021, also hitting 21 home runs. This is a very, very much of a stacked lineup. This is just nuts, Brandon. But we've got to also explore the pitching side, which I think it might be slightly weaker than the hitting, but still very solid in the top. Do you want to go over them?
Sure. So as when Kazuki and I met earlier this year, between the two of us, we did not record this. I said Spencer Strider is going to win the NL Cy Young Award. And I stick by that because Spencer Strider has a 20-5 record with a 3.86 ERA and a 2.85 FIP over 32 games started. He pitched over 185 innings, has 13.5 K per nine, 281 strikeouts, 5.5 WAR. He is their ace. He broke a ton of seasons. He bought the season strikeout, all-time single-season strikeout record from John Smoltz, who originally had it in 1996 at 276 strikeouts. He is their starter. Now, Max Fried is on track, according to reports, to come back, start game two. Spencer Strider, very much in line to start game one. After that, Charlie Morton is not going to be available. He will miss the NLDS. He's still prepared to come back next season, but right now he is injured. He had a 14-12 season with a 3.64 ERA starting 30 games, but he's been on the IL since mid-September, which is unfortunate. But the bullpen, let's go to the bullpen. In the bullpen, we have a 3.81 ERA with a 9.8 K per nine, a WAR of 5, and they have a home run to fly ball rate of about 12.4%, which is it's very good. The pitchers will highlight AJ Minter, Raisel Iglesias, Nick Anderson. AJ Minter is my setup man. He is definitely one of the best out there. 3.76 ERA with 11 Ks per nine innings and a 71.4% left on base percentage. If you remember, we're judging this pretty much all against the Baltimore bullpen. The Baltimore bullpen is the class bullpen. This is getting pretty close. Raisel Iglesias has 33 saves as their closer with a 2.75 ERA and a left on base percentage of 76.5%. Now, you highlighted Nick Anderson, and I am forgetting what happened with Nick Anderson in 2020.
He was the most overused pitcher from the Tampa Bay bullpen.
Oh, that's
who gave
right.
up that lead.
He pitched every game with the Rays. Now he's on the Braves. He has a 3.06 ERA with a 9.17 K per nine over 35 innings pitched. So not a whole lot of usage compared to the other pitchers, but definitely he's mattered. And the question is how will the Braves manage it? We know Brian Snitker is very good at his job, and we'll see how that goes. Keys to success. I'm going to take the Phillies, and I'll let Kazuki talk about the Braves since he went through all their things here. They need to be hot at the dish. Their defense needs to be definitely keep going, and that is Christian Pache, Rojas, the left field, center field combination. If you remember, Bryce Harper is still at first base, so it's got to be that combination. Wheeler and Nolan, you go deep into games.
We don't see Kyle Schwarber out there anymore, so I think that's a good part.
Right. Kyle Schwarber is not playing the outfield as much as it. He's more playing DH. So Wheeler and Nolan definitely deeper into games. That bullpen, Alvarado, Hoffman, Soto, Kimbrel, Kirkering, those players really need to step it up and pitch like they did last year. Kirkering being the newest addition who wasn't there last year. And they need to win one game at Truist Field in Atlanta. They need to win one. Just win one at Truist Park. You need to win one, because if you come back to Philadelphia and Hank can play three games, is it three games at home or two games at home? It's a five-game series. So it'll be 2-2-1.
It's 2-2-1, yep.
So you got to take the upper hand so you can win both your games at home. If you win both your games at home, series is over. 3-1, walk out, move on to the NLCS. What do the Braves got to do to win?
Braves, obviously, they're getting rested. They didn't have to play the wild card series because of the bye, because of securing the home field advantage throughout the entire playoffs. I would say for the Braves, they need to keep hitting those home runs, especially from their two highest paid and most valuable players in Acuña and Olsen. They need to hit a lot of home runs and get on base and make that traffic. And they need to make Wheeler and Nola work so that the Phillies have to go to their bullpen. Even though it's a good bullpen and a much improved compared to any other Dombrowski playoff team I've ever seen, you still need to get to that bullpen. And then the pitching, Strider and Fried needs to pitch deep into games because the bullpen is running short on the Braves side. And if the starters can't shut down that Phillies offense, it might be trouble, or otherwise the Braves offense needs to keep up. So, and lastly, the bullpen needs to lower their home run rate. They very much going to give up a lot of home runs. So you guys have to prevent that in order to not lose these close games.
Pretty simple there. You got to stick to the program. And we go to the other side. We're going across the country, taking that long flight to Southern California. We'll see on TBS and Max as well. Same TV setup for the Diamondbacks versus Dodgers, not a divisional matchup. And the Dodgers went 8-5 versus the Diamondbacks in 2023. Dodgers have won five straight, all played since All-Star break. Some quick hitters about the Diamondbacks. They didn't use Merrill Kelly for the Brewers series, so he can be available for game one if they so choose. Gabriel Moreno, the starting catcher, we do not know his status. He's considered day. And Evan Longoria is by far the most experienced player on this roster in terms of playoff experience. So how will he do? And that bullpen is from game one of the Brewers series. That couple days off will hopefully be ready. Zach Gallen did valiantly in the Brewers game in game two. So we'll go to the Dodgers side. I'll run through a couple of things here. I have a couple of questions for Kazuki here to go through. Number one, game one starts by Clayton Kershaw. He knows this very well. This is a familiar setting for him. What's going to be? My next question, Kazuki, quickly is, what will that rotation be like otherwise? Because there's one person who is currently, you know, under investigation for a brutal crime, and that's Julio Urías, and he is not participating with the team right now. So what is the rest of the rotation going to look like in your eyes?
So for me, I think the number two starter, he's going to be a huge key. And it's a rookie, Bobby Miller, who has a great velocity, 98 to 100 miles per hour fastball. Was incredible talent, but obviously he has not pitched deep into games. And he, I think if he could take a step up during this series, Dodgers could win a lot of games. And the other one is the acquisition of Lance Lynn from the White Sox. He is an innings eater, and he has really revitalized his career because he was pitching to a 6 ERA in the White Sox uniform, and he's pitching to a solid 2.5 ERA here in LA. So he needs to really, his fastball needs to keep showing up, and he needs to keep on striking out hitters. And lastly, it's going to be Emmett Sheehan if they were to pitch game four, who is another rookie that they need to rely on for these innings. But I think for the most part, my guess is the Dodgers will be a three-man rotation with a lot of bullpen games just because they have
right,
so many Tommy John
so
rotation.
Unlike, it's so unlike compared to like, you know, we have this massive staff. They don't have that. They don't have that this year. They have tons of injuries.
Yeah.
So we'll
like,
see how that goes.
You know, obviously the Dustin May and Tony Gonsolin, like Tommy John surgery is really hurting them. And then Walker Buehler not being able to come back on time from his rehab is something to really talk about. That's going to be tough. So Dodgers is basically running back similar to a 21 club, but I think they have potential to really beat this club because of their offense, which you listed here.
This Dodgers lineup, pretty much all the players that Kazuki mentioned, have been in place the back half of the year when they were trailing the Diamondbacks, trailing even the Giants to make it to the postseason. And they came storming back with this lineup. So they definitely are there. The team has three players, 30 home runs or more. Muncy, Betts, and Martinez. Max Muncy has a pretty paltry 212 batting average, I think, for the season. So that's something to look out for. Mookie Betts.
He's basically the Kyle Schwarber of that team. Low batting average, high home run. But we got to talk about Mookie Betts. He's having the best season of his ages since 2018.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely defensively and offensively probably the most important player for this team. This series and the rest of the whole season. Then JD Martinez is the DH this year, who's also 30 home runs, but more on Mookie Betts from you.
Yeah, Mookie Betts. I mean, he's having an MVP caliber season. If Ronald Acuna was not in place, he probably would likely win the MVP here. And he had the biggest month of August I've ever seen from anyone, hitting .455, was a .1355 OPS, 11 home runs and a total of 51 hits. Hotter than Julio, I think, for that month of August, which catapulted him to /NF .307, 39 home runs and 107 RBIs, and he's a leadoff guy doing all of this.
Yeah, this is a leadoff hitter, and he is probably the premier leadoff hitter in all of baseball.
But Brendan, we're forgetting one player. I feel like we need to talk about this guy. He is an all-star, and I feel like at this point, is he underrated? I mean, he's been around the league forever, and that's Freddie Freeman.
Yeah, Freddie Freeman not being a player that I put in this rundown is surprising even to me. Freddie Freeman's probably the best contact left-handed hitters in all of baseball.
And having a phenomenal year, too.
Right, and the fact of the matter is he's not top billing for this lineup, which is unreal because that's what he was for so many years. But Mookie Betts having the season of his life. And then Freddie Freeman, you know, batting the middle of the order, being as integral as ever to, you know, defensively and offensively.
I mean, I will say this. He had the most double of this season. It was 59 doubles. He is a double machine.
Right. And when we get to the keys, that's the player that I think is going to be the most important to keeping the Diamondbacks bullpen and starters at bay, keeping them, pushing them to the limits. It's going to be Freddie Freeman in the middle of that lineup. The middle of the lineup's got to push them and farther and farther and farther. This roster has 10 players that have, like the Orioles, have played 110 games together. So it's a lot of players play the same way. My questions are, how much are they going to use a player like Chris Taylor, who can play any position on that field? What are they going to use Chris Taylor for? Are they going to use him as a pinch hitter? Are they going to start him? That's my one thing.
And
my
I think question, he's defensive alignment at this point. Right. You know, he's going to substitute a player and it's going to be a matchup base just because he's been struggling.
Which is perfect for him. And the second thing is Mookie Betts, we have seen Mookie Betts play the outfield and shortstop and second base this year. Depending on where they start him, they can, you know, rearrange the line to get Jason Hayward in, who's been having a decent year, but great defensive player. So they can move the players around probably bit more than that. Flexibility is going to be very important to them going forward into this series. And the last storyline I'll have for this is you have two rookie of the year contenders in the National League in this game. And that's James Outman and Corbin Carroll. And I think when we think of the Dodgers, we always talk about players been there in the league for years and years and years and years. Their youth on their mat on the mound is one thing. The youth in the outside, youth on the field is another thing. I'm excited to watch James Outman play. I'm excited to watch Corbin Carroll get another round in. That's kind of where I stand on like the major things. So let's get into keys to success. Again, I'm taking Diamondbacks. Let's do this one. I'll give the Dodgers to you. The bullpen pitch well above expectations against the Brewers. Can they keep that up? Can they keep that comeback mentality where if they get down, they can still, you know, grind it out and get a win? And Corbin Carroll, Gabriel Moreno, and other players really need to keep up with it. And hope Moreno is okay and able to pitch. I mean, able to catch and play after getting, you know, hit with the bat in the Brewers series. But to the Dodgers, other than Freddie Freeman needing to Freddie Freeman all over the place, what do the Dodgers need really to do to have a chance here?
Definitely, they need the pitching, especially Clayton Kershaw, to start it off strong. He, as a veteran, he needs to show up in these series. And because of lack of starting pitching, he needs to pitch well. He needs to be like CC Sabathia in 09. He needs to be himself from the 2020 season in order to get to that bullpen. And that old bullpen, while solid, cannot be overused. They have a solid bullpen in Evan Phillips, Brewstar Gratterall, Caleb Ferguson, and Alex Vesia. And those are capable of shutting players down, but they do need to just have the starting pitching of Lance Lynn and also Bobby Miller to go at least six innings so that they don't overuse their arm. And then lastly, the bats, unlike last postseason, it cannot die. This past last year, it was Freddie Freeman just hitting, which really made them lose against the Padres. And they need their bats like Mookie, Muncy, Will Smith, everyone else to start hitting the ball, and then Freeman to do his job, obviously. And he's been probably the most consistent hitter out of the bunch from that team. So, and luckily now that JD Martinez is at least in this roster, distributing more contact bats and less strikeouts that the Dodgers could look forward to. So I think that's the keys to my game for the Dodgers to be successful in this series.
And this series will start Saturday night, 9 p.m. Eastern on TBS or MAC. Whichever you so choose. That's the preview. That's the end of the show. Thank you all for sticking with us. We're sorry about the whole LinkedIn audience, you know, having the technical difficulties again. I am writing an error report to them. Hopefully we'll get it solved. If not, the audio platform is still where we keep everything. So make sure you stick around there. We will share these on LinkedIn with our LinkedIn crew when we get these posted on Spotify, wherever you get your favorite podcast. Until next time, shout out to the usuals, the Cowboy Bob, people of regular Virginia, the dogs, we've got Winnie, Bandit, Gatsby, all of them, number one baseball podcast for all the pets. Again, our plan is to be back before the championship series begins, just like this one. It will probably be audio because I have my fingers crossed, but I don't have faith that we're going to have a worthwhile solution by then. So hope for the best. And until then, we hope to see you on the field again soon. Enjoy the baseball.
That's it for this episode of Sayonara Baseball. This episode of Sayonara Baseball is hosted and produced by me, Kazuki Akiba, and Brandon Beiser. This episode was edited by Kazuki Akiba with additional research by Brandon Beiser. Our theme song is by K. Margus. Sayonara Baseball is a production of Daylight and Media 3 Limited. We'll be back with another episode. If you like this podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast as more people will know about this show. Go to daylightinteractive.com to see some exclusive updates and more about our upcoming shows. I'm Kazuki Akiba.
And I'm Brandon Beiser.
And this has been Sayonara Baseball.